My name is Aftar Burji, and I was born on the 15/12/1944.
And where were you born?
I was born in a small village called Bika, spelled as B-I-K-A, in Punjab. And I was one when we moved to Uganda. And my father was at the time a police officer, and then in about 1949-50 he started his own business, construction business, and because we used to travel a lot, and in 1951-52 we settled in Kampala, where my father concentrated getting jobs in Kampala itself, in the city. And I went to a guinea pig school, which was a demonstration primary school, where the teachers used to get their training done. And we had a very, very successful results in the pre secondary school exams, and then I moved on to a very promising secondary school, which is, that's where I started my hockey in 1960. Mm-hmm. Hockey exactly wasn't my first love. Cycling used to be my first love, and I've got I had four brothers and myself, which is five, and they were all about 6 foot, and I was the shortest one in the family. And they all were good athletes. My elder brother excelled in hockey, and one day when they were short of players, and they asked me to stand in at and the left side of the pitch, and the instructions were, you stop the ball and just hit it in. And that's what I did. And then they said, oh, you're good, you should come next week again. And that's how I started my hockey career.
And was this a club?
Yeah, it was a club which was run by the Six. The hockey was mainly played by the Six. In Uganda, the hockey was played by Six, a few Muslims, and the Goans were pretty good. And then they had a European side as well, which is who had settled in Uganda. So they used to have a triangle or four-side league. Six versus Muslims, and then Muslims against Goans, and Goans against Europeans. So this is the league that we had going around.
What was the name of the club?
We were called Ramgarhia, which is Ramgarhia Hockey Club. And then it later on, it became a Sikh Union, became another a club as well, which was very, very good. Everybody could join in Sikh Union, and that's where I eventually started playing. I came to do my further studies in England in 1966, and I was still cycling at the time, and then I went to see a friend of mine at Hayes Hockey Club, because I was studying at Kingston College. And I had my cycling shoes on, and I saw this guy playing mixed hockey. And they asked me if I could play hockey. I said, I can. They asked me to join them and turn up next Saturday. Sunday. The mixed hockey used to be on Sunday. So I turned up to play hockey on the grass pitch with my cycling shoes, which used to have a mat metal plate at the bottom. And they do that. And then I realized that you can't play hockey with those shoes. So I had to spend, I think it was £1.50 or £1 to get shoes. It was a lot of money because I used to only get about £20 a month from home, £20-25. And that's how I started my career. And then eventually I started playing Saturday hockey with Hayes Hockey Club. And within a few weeks, I was virtually playing first 11 hockey because I had played hockey before. And then I, in the summertime, I met a friend, a guy called Steve Grimmer. His younger brother played for England, and they invited me to play for London Indians. London Indians was a team, collection of people who played Asian style of hockey. It didn't. It was run by Jimmy James, who formed a club to preserve and excel in Asian style of hockey. So he formed London Indians because there were quite a few Anglo-Indians in England at the time. So we started playing this on Sundays. It became so good and popular and successful that they would only play county hockey against counties and England to give them match practices because before they went abroad. And it, then I left England in 68, went back to Uganda, and I started playing hockey in Kampala for Sikh Union. And I didn't play international hockey because we were very busy work-wise, but I played club hockey. In 71, I was due to travel to Zambia to play All Africa Games. But the last minute I had to cancel, pulled out, due to work, because we had just won the biggest contract in Uganda at the time. Then I got selected for 1972 Olympics. We qualified for the 72 Olympics.
How did you qualify?
Because we finished second in Africa, and there was a slot which we had applied for, and there was an empty slot because somebody had applied late, or if it was technical fault, then we got, because we were the first reserve team for the Olympics. So we got the invitation. And once we got selected, we were in the camp. There were 24 people in the camp, and then they had to narrow it down to 18. And while we were in the camp, a residential camp, where the Idi Amin announced that all Asians must leave the country in 90 days.
And how did you feel about that?
Well, we were very tensed, and we didn't know what to do. So we asked our chief de mission to clarify our position, what to do. And he went and consulted the top brass, and then he came back. He said, you have two options, either to go ahead and participate in the Olympics, or you get shot.
Was that serious?
Well, this is a message we got, that the there are two options. One is to play, the other one is not going to be pleasant.
So you all elected to play?
Willingly.
Yes.
Yeah, but once we were there, and the thing is, we were not very politically motivated, or we didn't have too much political information, and we were not too much politically involved in anything. We were only sports people. So once we reached the Olympic Village, then we found a lot of press and everybody following us all the time. And they wanted stories, what was happening behind us. We were warned not to talk to press. But even then, some journalists were so smart, they pretended as if they were athletes, and they managed to get some information from the Asians, how they felt, and what somebody within our group was not wise, and he said that he criticized the government, and that was very worrying. And then the meeting was called in the village to find out who said it. And because our chief demission was very nice guy, he advised us that we should try and distance ourselves from this, what was in the press, all hugely controversial issue, and just concentrate on hockey. So we went, myself and there's another friend of mine, we went to the press city, and we spoke to the journalist who had, it was the New York Times, which was published in Paris. They had printed the story. So we went and met him, and we explained the situation to him. And I asked him, who said it to you, and who told you this story? And then we tried to cover it by saying, there are quite a few sick boys in the Kenyan team. Quite likely, they must have given you this information to stir up things between us and Kenya. So that dampened the whole issue a little bit.
Did you know that was true, or was that just speculation?
I think it was true, but we had to somehow suppress it by trying to blame somebody else to take the blame. So it was advised by the officials in the Uganda, Uganda officials, to try and work the way so that that blame doesn't, they don't name the person who said it.
Right.
Because otherwise that person would have never survived back in Uganda.
So even though the rest of the Asian community had been given 90 days to get out, you and all the Asians playing in the hockey team were asked to carry on and go to the Olympics. Were you expecting to have to leave Uganda once you got back afterwards?
Well, we were not in that position. We were not thinking that far ahead, but we knew things are not going to be right. So I was getting a call back from Uganda, through London. I was getting the message through that my brothers and sisters were packing up, and my father was exempted. He was given special clearance to stay, and because of his projects, the projects we were doing for the government. So that was the story that I was getting. Once we finished our the Olympics. In between the Olympics, you know, we had that tragedy of Israelis who were killed.
Yes.
I think it was 5th of September that the whole the Black September, they used to call a group called Black September. They jumped over the fence. The fence wasn't very secure. It was a chain link fence, about 6 foot high, and the security wasn't very tight. The people were very friendly, and these guys, they were dressed as athletes, and they jumped over the fence, and they got into the Israeli quarters, and those quarters were double-story quarters. Where we lived, they were about 5-6 stories, and their quarters were pretty close to the fence as well. And we didn't know much what was happening inside, because they were we knew there was something going on, and that day the games were suspended. And in the evening we found out everything is over, and the next day we got the message that there's going to be kind of a mourning day in the stadium, and it was advised that we should all get together in the stadium, and there the announcement was made. The games will carry on, because if they stopped, it would be a victory for Black September. And then we learned from there that one German soldier was killed, 7 Israeli athletes were killed, three Black September terrorists were captured, and it was a sad day. It was a very, very sad day, and
but you were unaware of what was happening at the time.
Yeah, it was. We saw the picture of the guy, because our quarters were higher up, and then we could see to their balcony, and everything. Balcony was on the our side, and the doors were on the other side. It's only once we saw in the balcony one person, and after that we never saw anybody. Even before the Olympics started, you get all the African countries. They threatened the Olympic Committee that they were going to pull out because of Rhodesia still had link with South Africa, the apartheid regime. Was in power in Rhodesia, Ian Smith. Mm-hmm. So that was a controversy to start with the Olympics. So we were packing and unpacking our bags till the last 2 days to go, when Olympic Committee withdrew their invitation from Rhodesia, and they were expelled from the village. That's when we knew that we were going to participate.
Okay. Tell me that story about the Pakistanis voting with their receiving the medals with their feet.
Oh yes, see, the thing is with that one, I blame Pakistanis themselves. What happened is on the short corners, they were running. Firstly, the Germans were running early. Secondly, nobody picked on that. It's up to the Pakistani injector to stop injecting the ball. And the second thing was, there was their own Pakistanis' fault. They lost the game. And then when they were given the medal, this guy, who is a sheikh, very hot-headed guy, I know him really well, he was the first guy who put the medal in the shoes. And they were banned for I think for life, and then they lifted
it for two years.
Yeah,
and 8 out of that 11 played in the next Olympics.
Yeah, but the thing is, the same guy became a coach, and then when they went to India about 5 years ago, when Pakistanis beat India in India, the the players went up to the crowd, took their shirts off, doing this and doing this. I mean, the coach who had gone through all this thing that this is all political now, that you don't do things like that, he never, ever even spoke about it. He should have told them that, look, this is what happened. This is what's going to happen if you do that. I'll tell you an inside story. When I became a captain of London Indians, and I said to these guys, I said, you get warned by umpire, automatically you're not going to play the next game. Automatically. It doesn't matter whether it's your fault, umpire's fault, it doesn't matter. The reason for that is, you put the ball in the net and then we will see. No need complaining up here. We went to Spain, not a single card, not a single warning. The reason? Because we didn't want that the stigma the Asian players had. And London Indians were the ones we were disciplined. I said, you're good enough to finish the game off. Why do you want to get into that thing? And you get rid of the ball before you're punished. Right. So, you know, these are the how you overcome these hurdles.
I think you had some other interaction with Idi Amin before the.
Yes, it is. Before we took off from Entebbe, there's normally a ceremony. Where the president gives you the flag, hands over a flag to the team leader, and it was done in a cinema, and he came there, he just gave a flag in the evening, and then he virtually ordered the Uganda Olympic Committee within a short time that he must have a blazer, just like the Olympic boys. And the full kit, like Olympians, and that he would like to see the team before they fly out at the State House at 11 o'clock on the flying day. And we were there, 10:30, we had our tea and biscuit and waiting for him, and we waited till about 12:30, then we got a phone call saying that he's stuck somewhere, he won't be able to make it. So you guys go ahead and board the plane and go to the Olympics and good luck. And when we were about to board the plane, about 2 o'clock I think it was, and he called us back. We got a call from the State House saying that he's back and he would like to meet you. And so we had to come back to the State House, take pictures with him, shake his hand, and then get back on the plane about 4 o'clock. The flight took off. And there were passengers who had traveled from South Africa and Nairobi. They were in the plane getting roasted in the midday heat in Uganda. He had no care for anybody else apart from himself. Eventually we left her there. The Olympics, and obviously in the Olympics we did Uganda. It was the first Olympics for us. We were a young team, and we did quite well. I think we were the only team that drew with West Germany 1-1, and even that they scored in the last minute. Germany to equalize, and when we got back. To the State House, we got back to Uganda after the Olympics. There was a press conference. At the press conference, all the African journalists were only interested in one question: who said and why and condemning the political party in Uganda. But our chief diplomat, Francis Nangweso, who was a brilliant, he was Cardinal Francis Nangweso, so he was brilliant because he had been to a lot of Olympics and he held very high position in the boxing board of the world. So he was quite aware of how to deal with press. So he suppressed his question very nicely. And E.D. mean, then we were given, next day we were invited to a big hotel in London, in Kampala, where E.D. mean received us and declared all the Asians were given the Uganda citizenship, and they were given special privileges. So they don't have to leave the country.
So did they all stay?
None of them stayed. They all left quietly. My father was left behind, and then virtually he was... The stories were that soldiers were making people sign checks, and they were cashing the checks, and then they were shooting the people, especially the Asians. And my father was virtually picked up by the army. And because our workers, we had about 700 people working for us, the workers complained that my father is planning to run away without paying. So army picked up my father and they took him to the bank and made him draw the money and pay the workers. And my father contacted the British embassy because he had a British passport. They advised him to leave the country as soon as possible and for his own safety, though he had exemption to stay, but he was not safe.
No.
So my father had gave all the moving vehicles, trucks, to a church. We had a very good connection with Church of Uganda. My father gave those movable assets to the church and signed over the vehicles. The other assets, like properties, buildings, nobody could transfer because there was a restriction on it. You couldn't sell the cars or anything like that to a private person. So my father, I had already left Uganda with no sign of having any equipment to say that I was an athlete or played in the Olympics, because most of my stuff I had sent with my friends from Munich to London with friends who had come to see the games. So when I landed here, we had no money. I stayed a couple of weeks with my sister, then we rented a place. Then my father turned up with virtually nothing, empty-handed. He stayed here about 3 months. And then he moved to Kenya because some friends had from Uganda had moved to Kenya. And he started his business in Kenya. So then I joined him in Kenya to carry on with my life and play hockey in Kenya for a while. And in Kenya I got shot one time after a coaching session. Seven robbers they came into the clubhouse and they started shooting randomly, and I got shot and the bullet went through my calf, and I survived that and I came back to England, and then I settled here as my kids were growing up in 97, 98. Well, I got shot in 96, Olympic year. And that's the
Was that why you left Kenya?
No, because my family was here as well. So my father died, and obviously the brothers didn't agree how the business should be run. So, and by this time, our property in Uganda was returned as well. So one of my brothers moved to Uganda. I was in Uganda as well. Then I had medical problems. I developed some medical problems, so I had to stop playing hockey, and I had to be near hospital in England for the medical reasons. And my family was growing up as well.
So you played hockey till, what was that, about 91
probably. I'll say I played pretty competitive. Played for competitive in the sense I played for Lamans, which was, there was a guy called Jim Pollock when I was here and studying here. He looked after me like his son. Guildford Angels, and he used to pay for me to travel all over the world with him. And then there was Gerald Wilkinson. He died as well. And Peter Child, who settled in Munich, a good friend. These guys were kind of a father figure, and they'd look after me well. And the last time I played for Lamas, Tim Brooking was the man. And then I had a serious medical problems in 91. Here, because I was here at the time. Then I went back to Kenya, and then the condition got worse and worse, and then I had to come back again.
So you played right through from when you were 1960 through to 96.
I played.
So
yeah,
37 years. That's quite a long
time. Long time, yeah. Long time, yeah.
What position did you play?
At the international level, I played left half. And a lot of the times I played centre. For Surrey County, I played inside left mid. So I played with Gavin Featherstone for some time when I was here in England, 72 to 78 when I left for Kenya, and I played for Surrey County. And Gavin came in, I think, 77. Ian Pink, I think, and Parson, they were there at the time. And Neil Francis, who went on to play for, and there's a he played for England. Barker was another keeper. He was in our Surrey team. So we had quite a few international in the Surrey team at the time. Graham Evans, who played in Munich 72 with me, he was inside right. And I was a captain of London Indians from 73 to 78 till I left for Kenya.
Was there a big difference between the type of hockey played in England and the type of hockey played in Uganda and Kenya?
See, here there's more kind of structured hockey. Discipline in the sense they tell you how to play hockey, what to do on the pitch. You're given a specific rule. Asian style of hockey is played off the cuff. And with that one is, you have to have a lot of flair to play that hockey. But the European style of hockey is very direct, fast, one-touch hockey, two-touch hockey. It didn't work very well on the grass pitches, but is very effective on AstroTurf. That's why the Asian style of hockey died as soon as the AstroTurf came in, because playing off the cuff didn't work. That's now the Indian, what they, because I have been covering a lot of international matches because of my media work that I do. Now I've seen the Indians especially have maintained their off the cuff hockey, but with a lot of discipline, possession hockey, which was mastered by the Australians. So now all the other teams are following the same pattern. Looking at the GB girls and the GB boys, they have a lot of flair. One to one, they can easily eliminate a player. But it's only in certain areas they're allowed to do that. And Indian ladies, they don't have the pace. They don't have the strength to compete with the Europeans, but they, because of their skill level and their because of their body position very low, they dispossess players very easily. But then getting away from them is a problem for them. The men's side is looking better now, a lot better. So compared to the type of hockey, we copied Indians because we never came in contact with Europeans playing in India, in Kenya and Uganda. That was a difference.
Which did you enjoy most?
Well, I was very fortunate because I could easily, when I came here, when I first came to Blackheath, I met Rui Saldana, who played for GB in the 72 Olympics. He said, look, if you move to London, we are a good club and we have qualifications in the team. Come and join us. And because he was a GB player, so I joined them because I lived in pretty close to Blackheath. Well, I was living in Surrey, and Blackheath is in Kent. So when I joined them, they said, oh, you must go and play for, join the Kent. So I went, they sent me to Kent trial. The only one match I played, and after the match, these guys said, oh, you're a good player, but you don't fit into the system. I accepted that, and then in April, we went to play at Western Supermare. There were, I think, 140 teams. And out of the 140 teams, they wanted to select 13 players to play exhibition match against the German side. And we had people like Joe Ahmed, Rui Saldana, a couple of other England boys in our team. And they wanted players who were either county players or internationals. So my name was not submitted because I was not playing county hockey. So they came to see Rui and the other guys, and they picked me to play center mid. And then they asked me, why am I not playing county hockey? I told them, because I don't fit into the system. He said, but the system, is what, if they tell you what the system is, you can easily play there. He said, would you like, he said, where do you live? I said, I live in Surrey. He said, would you like to play for Surrey? I said, yeah, I just want to play hockey. So they invited me for a trial for Surrey. And then I never looked back. I played for Surrey. And then Kent, when we beat Kent, and they asked me to come back, I said, no way. So when I get into a situation like this, my father said, don't take it as a negative, take it as a challenge. Mm. So any refusal, any disappointments, I take it as a challenge in life. And I've been coaching a lot of teams. I have had a lot of success in the last 20 years, I think 14 promotions I've had.
Is this for Blackheath?
No, for different clubs. Wimbledon, Bracknell, Hendon, Hampstead, Spencer, Teddington, So I was the director of coaching at Richmond. We went five leagues up. So it's a challenge. Now, last 3-4 years, I've given up. This year, I'm just helping a friend of mine in the 3rd-11 Spencer Hockey Club, just to enjoy and keep my contact with hockey.
You've seen hockey change a lot over the years and the rules change. Do you think you'd enjoy playing under the current rules?
I would have enjoyed in every situation. Because in modern hockey, it's ever changing. The other one was pretty static in the sense that grass hockey, when my first time I played, the London Indians played England. We used to play, because we didn't have coaches or anything like that. The captain used to be the coach and everything. And we used to play five in front, which is with midfield, the insides, and then we have three midfield and the two backs. That's a system we always played. The Indians always played. So three centre forward, right wing, left wing. And then the midfield, they used to drop back. It's like a W formation. Mm-hmm. And England couldn't cope with us. So the Europeans came up with a system where they started playing 4-4-2, man marking. And even then, we still got the better of England or the Europeans, because 1-to-1, they were good. They could easily eliminate a player and then create a space. When the AstroTurf came in, elimination wasn't that easy, because with the flat sticks and the ball was pretty flat, and the pace was fast. Mm. And with this new system, probably a very prominent writer in India asked me, how would the best players in India fare now? And I said, they wouldn't be in the team. They just can't get into the team. Or they wouldn't get into the team because they played at a snail pace, the midfield. He could take the ball, do this, do that. Here, everybody has to work equally hard. Now, people like my hero in those days, Ajit Pant, because he never had the pace, so he wouldn't have survived. And I said, well, it's difficult to compare. He might have pace in him, but he never showed. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult to compare that time and this time, the player-wise. It's comparing Pele to Messi.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, it's a different period, different times, and they were the best at their time there. So, would Messi have survived at that time, the way they were slicing people, they were hitting and chopping people? So, the umpires protect them now. Before, they were not protected. So, it's difficult to compare players.
Who was the best player you played with and the best player you played against?
See, there are two types of players. One are there is a physical player, which I call physical, is the mobility player, and the other one is like a thinker. You know, in hockey, you have control, you have a pass, and you have a run. If you have all these three, you're a complete player. Most of the players have one, a little bit exceptional players have two, and a complete player have all three. Mm. And we had a guy who was selected for virtually World 11, inside right, and Kuldeep. He was 6'2", very, very quick. Once he got the ball, it was difficult to get near him because, one, he had a good reach and he was very quick in my team. And he was brilliant. But if I had to pick between him and my captain, who's a neurosurgeon now, I would pick him because he could see things that nobody else could see on the pitch. And
His name was?
His name was Rajinder Sandhu, Rajinder Sandhu, Sandhu. Gavin Featherstone did a page on him in his book. Mm. He was a brilliant. That's the way I look at it. The player, the best player in my opinion, the couple of good players that I played, one was Manzoor Junior, he was inside right, captain of Pakistan team in 84 Olympics. He was considered to be the greatest inside right in his time. And Ajit Pal, who was the centre half for India at the time, was too very good. At my club level, Rui Saldana was brilliant, who was a GB player. He was a passer. He could see things, and he could, not very fast, but he could still run with the ball. And he was almost a complete player in our team.
What sort of training did you do?
Before the Olympics... The training, once we were starting with, we used to get up in the morning. We had to be there 7 o'clock. We did cross country. We came back, played hockey for an hour and a half, went to work, came back 7 o'clock in the evening, five o'clock in the evening, we were there, played hockey 7 to 7, we went in the gym and we did a lot of gym work. And then once we were in the camp for about a month and a half, we used to go for a cross-country run, which was 10 miles run. We used to leave the camp about 8 o'clock in the morning, do the run, come back, have a little breakfast, go indoors, have by 11 come out, play hockey, go inside because it's, you get hot, come back 4 o'clock outside, go for another run, come back, play hockey, do a gym work. Our gym work was all circuit training and medicine ball. We didn't have the weights or anything like that. You know, those days, there was no bleep test. Mm-hmm. But we used to do a lot of shuttles and used to do a lot of go up and down the steps, which was about 50, 60 steps, up 50, 60 steps down. Quite a few times we had to do that. We were virtually super fit. We could compete with anybody in the Olympics when it came to fitness because we had... 6 Africans in our team. Normally Africans are very, very good, very good athletes. And we had runners within the camp as well. We used to try and joke and compete with them. Obviously we used to be left in the dust. And they were that good. So playing hockey and running and mainly that kind of fitness we did.
You've travelled around quite a lot for your hockey.
Yeah, we did a lot of travelling in Africa, America, Canada, the whole of Europe virtually. Travelled to India playing hockey as well there. So a fair amount of travelling. Then eventually it gets pretty... tired and you get sick of it as well. In India, we traveled in a train, you know, from one city to the other. The hygiene wasn't that good at the time. The biggest problem used to be the belly, yeah. Deli belly, what they call
yes.
it. But now it's a lot better, a lot better. It's much, much better. And obviously you live in better conditions, you live in good hotels. Everywhere it's cooked food, you get bottled water. So I've been there now 5-6 times. I've been very lucky lately, you know, for the World Cups, the other tournaments. Never had any problem, never.
What are you doing now?
I stopped coaching a few years ago. Now I just summertime I play vets hockey now and then with Spencer. And I can, but with this Spencer Ladies Threes, it's a lovely group, and we bring the youngsters in, because I've always believed in youngsters coming through. You need to have at least three youngsters in the team to give them that confidence and belief. And normally they're much faster than. Obviously, they still have barriers because of the groups they have. You know, they dominate the scene because they don't want to let the group culture go, bringing in the youngsters.
Is there anything you regret about your hockey career?
No, I would say I would live it all again, because I met some absolutely brilliant people all over the world. It's amazing how people, once you tell them that you're a sportsman, how they're interested in you and your religion and your culture. And what do you do, and your family? I remember, playing in Ireland in Cork. Somebody asked me, "How do you tie your turban?" And well, if you don't know the thing, it's you just hold it one side and you wrap it around and you tuck it. And I told this group of the Irish people, and you know, when you're young you come up with these stories, and there are quite a few ladies, and I was pretty young, and you know, you're always there to impress people. And I said, well, you tie a brick one end and you go into the open yard and you swing this turban, and that the turban goes around your head and wraps. And then when the brick hits you in the head, you know that's the end of it, and you just tuck it. And they virtually accepted it. That's how you do it. You know, I mean, I have a lot of, I have a fair amount of imagination, because my communication and linking with people is such, I take it up, everything in a joking way, you know. And once they asked me, he said, why do you wear a black and the other guy is wearing white? And I said, oh, the white guys are virgins. And, you know, one time I was in Spain, they asked me, what do you do for a living? I said, I teach sign language to crocodiles. And they, when you imagination, it develops your mind, and how people accept what you say, and then they realize it after 10-15 minutes, and they come back and they start joking, and they become more friendly.
Yes.
Yeah, they, you know, it's a kind of an icebreaker, isn't it?
Yes.
There's a serious talk, I get serious, and when the other way, when they're just passing time, then you tell them this passing time stories. Yeah. I wouldn't change anything. I just wouldn't change anything. I had a lovely, lovely childhood. My father was very well to do. We lost everything in Uganda. no regrets whatsoever. We had to work hard here. We didn't accept no as an answer. If one door closed, we knew the other door will open. The biggest thing my parents gave me was the education. He said, material things, my father said, people can take it away from you. This they can't. So, and the other thing he said to me when I was leaving England, first time, he said, stay within your means. He says, it's very easy to go up and it's very difficult to come back. So ever since, I have never gone for fancy clothes, fancy food, anything fancy. And that has been the philosophy in my life and my family as well, with my kids. So some of the advice, and he said, be proud what you have, don't be arrogant about it. And he said, help if you can. There's nothing better than that. And I still give things. I still I do a lot of charity work in the, you know, as you know, the Sikhs are, the charity is their number one. Our home used to be called Ram is a Hindu god. Bhrosa means trust, God trust. Because people are trying to repossess their property back in Uganda. Our house was open and people used to come and live in our house to try and get their property back. And they named our house as a Ram Bhrosa Hindu Hotel. So anybody could come and stay in that house for free and have food free. And my mother used to say, that's why we are all blessed in our family, because of what we've been doing and what we've done. You can only do this if you're in that position. Unfortunately, if you're not, you want to do it, but you can't. So it's all where you are and how you are. You know, that's how the charity begins.
That's a lovely philosophical note to end. I'd just like to ask, when you look back, what's the main highlight that stands out most in your memory?
I think probably God has been great to me in many senses. I've survived. There are three coups, which is takeovers, political coup takeovers. I survived. First one, when Idi Amin came into power, he overthrew Obote. There was a lot of firing, a lot of shelling. I had to go to a remote place to rescue a person. And then there was the second one where we were virtually locked in when Tito Okello came into power by overthrowing Obote the second time. There were a lot of shelling, a lot of bombing. At that time, there was family was getting robbed, and I had to run across and to bring the young lady and her two kids to our place, which was higher up. And the people from the top of the hill, they were shooting at me. I managed to escape and get into the flat. So there are quite a few, really, and I'm blessed in the sense that God has always saved me. Then I think when I look back and say, it must be something that I've done that I'm getting. You know, there was a movie I watched, Seven Lives of Thomasina. I think the Pussycat or something like that. Yeah. Yes, I think my four lives, you know, these are the. When I look back, then I said, Christ, how lucky I am. How lucky I am. There may survival. Look, there's another. I was with. I went to play Brussels. We were in Brussels. Ian Russell from Guildford. He was the driver, and there was Chris Belshaw, doctor. We were travelling in the same car, with Tochi Puneser up front. Russell, Ian said to me, he said, Chris, who looked like Abraham Lincoln, he had a beard like Abraham Lincoln, he was sitting next to me in the back. He said, once we got to Russell, he said, look, I was playing centre half, and he said, don't pass the ball to Chris, because he hasn't played hockey much. He's a right winger. But I have always believed in playing right, finishing left, because easier to run on the right side, cross it in, put it in. The first game we played, we won, I think, about two. And I was sitting on the bar, drinking my chocolate, because I don't drink alcohol, never had beer or anything in my life. He sat, he came, I was having my chocolate milk. He came and sat next to me. I looked at Chris. I said, Chris, I have a confession. He said, what's that? He said, look, I was instructed not to pass the ball to you. But this game, every time I look at you, I want you to start running. Because you're a good runner, I saw you. All you're going to do is to pick up the ball behind the defender, run in and cross the ball. That's all you're going to do. He became a superstar in the next game. He became my so good friend. And when we were coming back from Brussels on Monday morning, I started vomiting blood. And he was next to me. I virtually passed out. He knew what was the problem. He kept talking to me. They stopped the car. And they got the called the ambulance out, and then they took me to Dunkirk. Tochi Puneser, who was in the car as well, he stayed behind. The rest, everybody went. I don't know what happened. I just passed out. And then I was told the following day my wife came, my brother, my daughter and son. They went away, but they gave my wife stayed back, and I was virtually in coma for 12 days. And then they found out my portal vein is blocked, and I was bleeding inside. I had virtually, and they couldn't give me any treatment. They brought me back to England, and they wouldn't let me come back unless I had two doctors with me. So I called Chris. Chris came over. And they gave him blood in case I started bleeding, so they could give me blood. And there's another friend of mine, we went to school together, he was a doctor. He came. So, you know, Chris has played a big part in my life, in saving my life. Tochi played a big part in my life. So when I came back to England, it took them 3 months to find out exactly what's wrong with me. And ever since, every 3 months, 4 months, now it's about 6 months, I go in there, they do endoscopy, wherever the varices are there, they suppress the varices, they inject varices, they put me to sleep, and they look after me. So national health has been God-saving for me. There's so many things in my life I wouldn't change for anything. For the people, I'm here because of other people. And sometimes I say, I'm here because there must be something I've done that God wants me to stay a little bit longer. So, which one do I pick? Isn't it?
Yes.
So, that's the way it is.
Thank you very much indeed.
No problem. Thank you. Thank you.
A lovely way to end and a wonderful series of stories. What an amazing life you have led.
Yes.
And it was lovely to hear about it. Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, thank you.